the United States versus Smith. Ms. Welsh.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kelly Welsh, and I represent the defendant appellant, Cassandra Smith, in this case. Ms. Smith requests that this Court vacate the sentence imposed by the District Court and remand her case for resentencing due to the District Court's failure to consider one of the principal, if not the principal, argument made by her prior to sentencing in a written sentencing memorandum, that being the disparate treatment between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. Before the sentencing hearing, I, on behalf of Ms. Smith, I represented her in the lower court, submitted an 11-page sentencing memorandum, at least half of which discussed the district court's discretion to impose a sentence below that called for by the advisory sentencing guideline range. And I discussed the specifics of Ms. Smith's case, including the 66.7 grams of crack cocaine that her case involved, and went through what the advisory guideline range would be if her case involved 1-to-1, 20-to-1, or 25-to-1, discussing that particular ratio because that's the lowest ratio that it contains that is still set forth within the current version of the sentencing guidelines. However, at the sentencing hearing, the judge passed over in complete silence our primary argument for a sentence below that called for by the range based on 66.7 grams of crack cocaine. There was no discussion by the district court of the disparity argument that Ms. Smith raised, and because of that, the district court procedurally erred and this case should be remanded. It is well-established law in this circuit that if asked, a judge must consider an argument raised by either side as to why a sentence within the advisory guideline range would be unreasonable. And once she's asked to consider that argument, there has to be some evidence in the record to demonstrate that she actually meaningfully considered the argument and either accepted or rejected it. And in this case, we have no indication. The only time that the district court mentioned the sentencing memorandum in our case was to ask at the very beginning if there was anything to add to the sentencing memorandum, to which I responded there was not, and we would rely on that document. So by asking that question, this court can be assured that the judge acknowledged the existence of our sentencing memorandum, but nothing more than that.
Well, isn't it fair that we presume she read it?
Well, we can presume, and I hope that we can infer that she did read it, Your Honor, but she never specifically said as much. And I think if we get into scenarios where a defendant is setting forth factually based, substantial, well-considered arguments, and it's the defendant's principal argument, and the judge makes no comment about it, but we simply infer that she read it, we're coming down this road where we just really don't know if she actually did or not. You know, this court has repeatedly said that frivolous arguments, meritless arguments, unsubstantial arguments can be passed over in complete silence, but not the primary principal argument put forth by a defendant.
Well, can we draw some comfort from the fact that the judge did mention the point about family circumstances, which was raised in the memorandum? Well, I mean, it does kind of indicate that the judge is aware of everything in the memorandum. I understand your point of the lack of mention, but of the one-to-one.
I don't think that this court can rely on the fact that the sentencing judge discussed Ms. Smith's history and characteristics. She did do so at length. That is but one of the 3553A factors that she has to consider. And frankly, all of the comments that the judge made about Ms. Smith's history and characteristics can be gleaned entirely from the pre-sentence report. So I think that the only thing that this court can really be assured of is that the judge read the pre-sentence report and considered the information in the pre-sentence report. We cannot be assured that she considered the entirety of Ms. Smith's sentencing memorandum, and particularly her arguments about the disparate treatment of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine offenders. A further indication, I think, Your Honors, that the judge did not meaningfully and conscientiously consider Ms. Smith's arguments about the disparate treatment of crack versus powder cocaine is the fact that the judge mentioned crack cocaine twice during the sentencing hearing. She mentioned it first to acknowledge that the guidelines had been properly calculated based on 66.7 grams of crack. And the second time that she discussed crack cocaine was to note that Ms. Smith was addicted to crack cocaine and had been using crack cocaine prior to her arrest in this case. Other than that, other than those two very discrete instances where the judge mentioned crack cocaine, she did not discuss at all Ms. Smith's argument about the disparate treatment of offenders in Ms. Smith's position.
Ms. Welch, I appreciate your experience. Counsel, can you think of an issue that has been more in the forefront on the sentencing agenda than the crack cocaine disparity? Now, I don't want to in any way detract from your argument about the need for specificity under 3553. We've spoken to that many times. But unless we have a real absence of a situation where maybe a relatively new judge or an issue that is kind of new in the sentencing, sentencing agenda, can you think of a matter which would not be more in the consciousness than the crack cocaine disparity? I mean, I'm asking only in your experience, not necessarily in derogation of anything you've said today.
Well, if I'm interpreting Your Honor's question correctly, I think what you're asking me is, this is in the forefront of everyone's mind, particularly in our district where we do see a lot of crack cocaine offenses. So clearly, it can be expected that the judge is aware of Kimbrough. She's aware of the modifications to the sentencing guidelines. But I think it's equally plausible to assume and hope that the district court is aware that the modifications to the sentencing guidelines as it relates to crack offenses was modest in the words of the Sentencing Commission by itself, that they would go even further to make more changes if they could, but it's only up to Congress at this point. So I think we can assume that the judge is equally aware that there are arguments that are in favor of lesser sentences for crack cocaine offenders, as she is that this is an issue in the forefront. But still, I think the important thing to come back to, Your Honor, is that we can't assume that she's aware of this. It has to be demonstrated in the record that she did meaningfully and conscientiously consider this argument, and it's simply not there.
Well, what should she do? Should she recite other ratios that are possible and comment on them, or what specifically should she do?
I think at a minimum, Your Honor, the district court has to acknowledge the argument that was made. She can simply say, I've considered the crack versus powder cocaine disparity argument in your sentencing memorandum, and for reasons A, B, and C, I'm imposing a sentence of 120 months. Had she done that in this case, we might not be here. But there was simply no acknowledgement in the record by the district court judge that she considered the argument for a lesser sentence. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. My name is Robert Anderson. I have the privilege of representing the United States in this matter. I'll try to be complete but brief in my argument here. The judge did not procedurally err in sentencing Ms. Smith, and nor was the sentence unreasonable. Judge Crabb did everything she procedurally needed to do in sentencing this defendant. She addressed the parties, asked if there were any objections beyond there were no objections to the PSR from the defense, actually. Asked if there were any objections from the defense, the defendant, about the PSR, its calculations. Smith, again, on the record, affirmed that she didn't have any objections to the PSR. The judge indicated that she had received and implicitly indicated she had reviewed the sentencing memorandum from the defense because she specifically asked defense counsel if she had anything she wished to add to the argument that was already advanced in the sentencing memorandum. And counsel said no, she had nothing more. She just wanted to rely on that sentencing memorandum. So implicitly, Judge Crabb knew of the sentencing memorandum and knew what was in it in order to ask whether there was anything more they wanted.
What was the government's response, if any, after Ms. Welch said she had nothing to add? Did you represent the government?
Yes, yes, sir.
Mr. Anderson, did you speak to anything in the memorandum?
No, the judge didn't ask.
No, I know. I appreciate you didn't make any inquiry, but I'm just wondering whether or not in advancing
our
government's concern
to
3553, be satisfied? Is it your practice, or is it the practice in the Western District to point out anything in the memorandum if the defense has only stood on the memorandum, so to speak?
Right. Well, most of the memorandum, I think more than half of it, pointed out what was not disputed. All the case law regarding Booker, Kimbrough, all that stuff. That's what the majority of it was. It then got down to advocating for its version of a sentence, which was about half of what the bottom of the advisory guideline range was. And that was based on the factors that, this argument about the disparity of the ratio is now based on the change of the guidelines, the two-level decrease in the guidelines, and based on her family history, her childhood. But that's all the stuff that the judge... No, to answer the question directly, no. She asked the government first if we had any objections, anything to point out. Then she went to the defense, and then she went into the sentencing and basically responded. What the judge did here was address the guidelines in passing the sentence, address the advisory guidelines, addressed, more importantly, the factors under 3553 that apply to this defendant. The judge indicated that her Smith's history, her lack of compliance with her criminal justice sentences in the past, directed that she deserved a sentence within that guideline range, though she still did give her a sentence at the bottom of that range. She looked at her childhood, which was mentioned in the sentencing memorandum. He looked at her teenage years, her resistance to rules and authority, her early drug use, her long criminal history, her past incarceration and rehabilitative efforts, which failed, which you can also see the judge referenced in the statement of reasons for passing the sentence she did, referring to the fact that Ms. Smith had been given these opportunities, had been given these past criminal justice sentences, and like in her youth, where
the objection here is that she didn't say anything about Kimbrough. Specifically what we're talking about?
Right. And my point is she didn't need to go into saying anything about Kimbrough, because this has been hashed in front of these courts repeatedly for months or years since Kimbrough was decided before that. So what the way in which the judge responded to her sentencing memorandum was addressing the factors under 3553. In other words, if I'll cut to the chase here, the pertinent factor in 3553A6 is whether there are unwarranted sentencing disparities, not ratios, not disparities in the ratios that are used to calculate the guidelines. You could probably go ad infinitum through various parts of the guideline book and find all sorts of differences or disparities right and left about the minutiae of how guidelines are calculated. But especially when these guidelines are only advisory, and especially when the judge, it is very clear from all the authority, which Judge Crabb was aware of and which were cited in more than half of the sentencing memorandum, the judge has discretion in exercising her sentencing. These ratio arguments are a red herring. It's the sentencing disparity, not ratio disparities, that are critical. The judge sentences based on considering the advisory guidelines, but weighing the sentencing factors under 3553, which is exactly what Judge Crabb did here. And she went through and noted all the problems with Ms. Smith, just like the previous case you heard, just like the Scott case. Judge Mannion referred to the Scott case in the earlier argument. That case also, it was driven by, not by the crack cocaine guidelines themselves or the advisory guidelines, but by the defendant's history and their characteristics, which the judge was examining under 3553. Here, the court concluded that there was a high likelihood that, given, especially since the fact that Ms. Smith was selling crack cocaine while she was under criminal justice supervision, while she was on probation, she's selling crack cocaine, a high likelihood that she'd continue to commit criminal conduct. Now, granted, the judge did not cite chapter and verse going through their memorandum and refuting it or itemizing a response to it, but not even the defense attorney made any further argument about her position in the memorandum. My point is, it wasn't necessary for the judge to have done this because, as I said, the ratios argument is really a red herring. What we're concerned about is unwarranted sentencing disparities, not disparities in the ratios that are used to give you an advisory guideline that the judge can use or factors into the use but still has discretion in passing her sentence. The record despite the fact that Judge Crabb didn't go ad infinitum through or item by item through the sentencing memorandum, the record clearly shows she was cognizant of the memorandum and inherently, in addressing those 3553 factors, rejected its call for such a substantially reduced sentence of about half what the guideline called for. There was nothing more procedurally the court had to do. It was, she said, it was no greater than necessary to hold her accountable, to protect the community, to give her the opportunity for further rehabilitation efforts, although apparently she didn't take advantage of the rehabilitation efforts earlier, and more importantly, to achieve parity with similarly situated offenders. They changed the guidelines because of the feeling, the Sentencing Commission changed the guidelines because of the feeling that the 100-to-1 ratio was too harsh and may have resulted in unwarranted disparities, but they uniformly reduced all those crack cocaine guidelines by two levels. Now, only consequentially did that then result in these different ratios within the crack cocaine sentencing advisory guidelines, but as I said, those aren't what's important here. And the Supreme Court in Kimbrough even recognized the 2007 guidelines reduced unwarranted disparities in sentencing, despite the fact that they're that created these differing ratios. The best way, as this court has said in the past, to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities is among similar crack cocaine defendants is for the courts to impose sentences within the advisory guidelines, because using the advisory guidelines or applying them in their advisory manner is the best way to avoid sentencing disparities. It keeps sentencing disparities at their low point, at their ebb. The defendant's argument is basically a disagreement with the commission's policy of how best to mitigate that 100-to-1 ratio. It is not proof that the unwarranted disparities are in sentencing once the two levels are applied across the board to crack cocaine offenses. While it is undisputed that judges have sentencing discretions pursuant to Booker and Kimbrough and the Spears case that they cited in their 28J letter, the district court is under no obligation to accept the defendant's proposition that sentences for crack cocaine and powder cocaine should have some sort of comparability. Here, the district court, importantly, the district court, using 3553, more in its weight, conducted an individualized assessment of this defendant, Ms. Smith's characteristics, and carefully balanced all the relevant factors and issued a sentence which was an appropriate sentence and that I would ask this court to affirm, unless there are any other questions.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Ms. Welch? Ms. Welch, let me ask you a question regarding one of Mr. Anderson's points about you're not proceeding to later, if you had the opportunity, perhaps you felt you did not, to point out that the court hadn't specifically addressed the disparity argument.
I'm sorry, Aaron, I missed the question.
Mr. Anderson suggested in his argument that you didn't further point out to the judge the argument that you are advancing today. Obviously, you preserved it, but is there some reason why you didn't have an opportunity to say, well, Judge, you haven't spoken to the disparity argument?
Well, Your Honor, the sentencing memorandum that I submitted to the judge for her to read was quite lengthy and substantial.
Oh, no,
so the assumption would be that she read it. At the end of the hearing, she did question whether there was anything further from either counsel.
Right.
At that point, I didn't ask her to...
Well, the reason I asked that, we had a case recently, not from your district, but from your state, dealing with Rule 11 pleas. And the obligation, if it is, from both the government and the defendant to... raise perhaps as best one can. Sometimes judges don't always make it as inviting, I recognize that. But raise the question of perhaps something needs to be either gone over or expanded on or indeed commented on if it hasn't been. Clearly, unless denied an opportunity, do you feel counsel has any obligation to, in your case, to raise with, in this case, Chief Judge Grab, did she want to make some further comment with regard to the argument she didn't specifically address?
Well,
certainly would help us.
I'm sure it would. You wouldn't have these cases. As a principal matter, the federal rules of criminal procedure don't require defense counsel to take exception to what the judge is doing. And, at the end of the case, when she asked if I had anything further, she had passed her sentence by that point in time. So I had nothing further to add, as it relates to the decision that she had already made. I think, too, we might end up getting into kind of a slippery slope kind of area where the court is then starting to call on defense counsel and even government counsel to essentially protect the judge from him or herself. I don't know that's an obligation that the court would want to impose on counsel, in every circumstance.
Yeah, but both counsel for the government and defense have an obligation to, prevent error or advance argument wherever possible. I know the theory that you can try cases to bury error, but I'd like to think most counsel don't come to court with that in mind.
Well, and I think particularly as it relates to the sentencing memorandum, I understand that I have an obligation to advance arguments on behalf of my client and prevent error in that regard. So as it relates to my representation of my client, so for that reason I submitted the lengthy sentencing memorandum setting forth everything that I thought was pertinent.
Oh, no question. I thought it is an extensive memorandum.
Just briefly to go back on a comment that the government made, Your Honors. The government said that the district court didn't need to mention Kimbrough at all. And I think, also going back on Your Honor's question, because it is such an issue at the forefront of every attorney's mind and defendant's minds and the judge's minds, it's more important that in a case like this where it was her principal argument that we can be assured that she actually did consider that argument and either accept it or reject it in this case. The government says that what's critical in cases like this is the sentencing disparity that might result, not the ratio disparity. And what was realized in this case was a four times harsher sentence for Ms. Smith based on the fact that the judge started with the crack cocaine guidelines and didn't move from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.